Hello, 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 Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the co-host of Your Politician Podcast, where myself and my high school best friend, Damian Galvin, tackle issues of importance to ourselves and Americans from across every spectrum, deconstructing the past to create a more beneficial and equitable future for people of all origins, creeds, races, and sexualities. Now, in today's podcast, we have a very special guest. Her name is Summer Rachel Jackson, a sixth-year organizational ethnographer and PhD student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology over in up north. Now, Summer talks to us about diversity and promoting diversity in every sphere, and more specifically in the workforce, promoting that kind of conversation between people. We're going to have a very, very insightful discussion with her for the first 30 minutes of our podcast. And after that, myself and Damian dive deep into a topic that's very, very emotional for a lot of Americans, people of color. Specifically, the death of Jacob Blake over the weekend that has been surfaced over the past couple of days, and details are being thrown out, and a lot of events are happening around that murder and that police brutality incident. So me and Damien talk about that very, very deeply after the first 30 minutes, so make sure to stay tuned for that segment. And that said, make sure to visit our website at www.polititeenpodcast.com. That is www.polititeenpodcast.com. A lot of amazing things coming out of there. That's your hub for everything Polititeen. And as a last shout out, thank you to our team, Jada Pilling for our graphics, and Yi Shen for our artwork as well, Julia Hartman for our research team. And that's pretty much it. Thank you guys, and we'll see you on the episode.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Polititeen. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hey, guys. My name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Polititeen podcast here with Damian. And today we're going to talk with an emerging public leader, emerging a business leader, emerging, you know, I think a political leader, for me to say, in the field of feminism, feminist studies, things like that around these political issues today. Polititeen as a podcast, for all of you who don't know, is about raising conversation about the most pressing political issues that we're dealing with today to promote a better future in the next 10, 20 years. Our goal is to look at the past and use the past as a reference to create a better landscape for the future. Now, today, to help us understand our past and our future, we have an emerging political leader. As I said, she's working public-private sectors on things like good governance, economic development, and sustainability. Her name is Summer Rachel Jackson. If you'd like to introduce yourself for any of our guests, Summer.
Sure. Thank you, Damian and Varun, for having me and for that wonderful introduction. My name is Summer Jackson. I'm a PhD student at MIT Sloan School of Management. And my background spans the public and the private sector, but currently, as part of my research as a PhD student, I focus on issues of organizational diversity and inclusion.
Awesome. And how did you get, you know, this is a question that we kind of have for all our guests, and I think it's very interesting to see how everyone's answer is different, but how did you go down this field? Obviously, we've talked to a wide array of guests. We've talked to older guests, younger guests, but you're very well established for being such a young and prominent figure. So what drove you into, you know, going into the field that you did?
That question. So I did international relations and feminist studies as an undergraduate at Stanford, and that was my hope coming out of that was to work for the government focused on issues of the Middle East and North Africa. I had grown up overseas in Saudi Arabia, and those experiences really informed how I approached the world and gave me a lot of insight into those cultures in a way that I felt like I could be of benefit to the public service and to the U.S. government. So coming out of undergrad, I spent a couple of years trying to get experience on the ground doing international development projects and working with civil society in the Middle East and North Africa, so in Israel and in Egypt and in Bahrain. And then I landed a job at the U.S. State Department, and that was, going in was going to be my dream job. And in many ways, it was able to live up to a lot of my expectations for that role, but I actually ended up facing sort of a dilemma in terms of how do I want to spend my life. There's this term that I've now learned working with the private sector that's more like, do you want to work on the business or do you want to work in the business? And if I stayed at the State Department, I would have been working in the business of international development and good governance, economic development projects, and civil society. But if I pivoted and got my PhD, I could work on the business, which is how do these large, public-serving, mission-driven organizations sort of organize and thrive to address these fundamental social problems that we face. And that pivot also allowed me to move beyond just looking at U.S. government, but going into the private sector, looking at issues of inclusion and diversity, and ultimately, I feel like has been a good decision on my part. I've really enjoyed my studies and the work that I've been able to do.
Awesome. And that's amazing to hear, Summer. I think that it's unique that you grew up in Saudi Arabia. I think that you speaking about how you've been involved because of your childhood experiences is inspiring for myself and Damien as growing political people, you know, having an equity in the political sphere. I think you mentioned how you work on inclusion and diversity, and you've mentioned this a lot of times on your website, your portfolio. And I think that in more circumstances than not, Summer, diversity is inclusion isn't actually a product of the promotion of diversity. It's the exact opposite. I think that, so for example, a personal anecdote of this was that I had a friend yesterday who told me that, you know, Varun, my dad asked me yesterday that, why do you hang out with Indian people so much? And he said that, Varun, I think of these people as they're not Indian. They speak my language, they eat my food, and they're accustomed to my culture. And I said that, he's like, you know, I think that that's why I hang out with so many Indians. And I was like, well, what if I was different than you? Would you still hang out with me? And he didn't really have a response. So I think that sometimes inclusion is the exact opposite of the promotion of diversity. It's more of the homogeneity that becomes of a society. I think that sometimes the more homogenous our society becomes, the more we're pushed towards being inclusive. But to be truly inclusive, if this makes sense to you, to me, means respecting the differences that are among us, because we're always going to have differences. So what is your take on the idea that sometimes inclusion is a byproduct of more homogeneity than it is diversity?
Interesting point that you bring up. Part of what I'm hearing is, you're right, it's not sufficient to just take a bunch of people from diverse backgrounds and pick your dimension. It could be race, gender, sexual orientation, or social class, or some other identity-based dimension. It's not sufficient to take those people and put them in a room and then say, now we have diversity and we have inclusion because we put them all in the room. You need to have structures in place that allow people to interact as equals. And part of what that means is, as you were talking about, it means not just accepting people because they're like you, even though they may be a different race or a different gender or a different social class. You have to be able to accept people for being different as well. And you need structures that don't sort of recreate inequality. So I'll give you an example from when I was trying to get the on-the-ground experience doing international development projects. I was living in Israel, and I was very much interested in the feminist movement there and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they had these multicultural feminist groups that brought together Jewish Israeli, Arab Israeli, European people who come from European Jewish communities, people who come from Middle East and North African Jewish communities, people who come from Somalian communities. They had all these different people together, and they were all supposed to be mobilizing around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and finding an inclusive solution to that ongoing crisis. And in many ways, they were replicating the social inequalities and the hierarchies that existed outside of their walls. So that came down to, where did they decide to meet? Whose communities did they feel more or less safe in? What languages did they speak in? And so I think that's a much larger example of, it's not enough to just bring together all these diverse people and diverse ideas. If you don't have structures in place for them to interact as equals, you're not actually creating an inclusive environment.
Yeah, I 1,000% agree with that. And something very interesting that I've picked up since literally our first guest, if I'm not mistaken, Ted Terry, he said that the only way to fight ignorance is, I think it was travel. I think that was his quote. And it's very interesting because last week we had Dr. Roberts on, a professor at Stanford, a psychologist specifically at Stanford, who studies kind of the way that different races interact and different people interact to diversity, depending on, you know, their environment and where they're from and their history. And something that was interesting about Dr. Roberts, and very similar to you, is that he also grew up outside of the United States and traveled. I remember him mentioning that he was actually born in Germany and could speak German. And I think that for a lot of our guests that are tackling the subject of diversity, one parallel that has always been drawn is that they themselves have, if I don't know if this is the proper use of the word, but they have themselves have been diversified. And although, what was the proper term that Dr. Roberts used? Was it, he was it wasn't biracial, it was mixed race, right? He was mixed race. And we had a crazy conversation about this on the podcast, and I really recommend that to anyone. But he said that he was mixed race, meaning that, you know, he had a white parent and a black parent. But that wasn't the reason that I think we saw him as fighting for diversity, or the reason that he was really even interested in it. It was the fact that he had been to so many different places and known so many people.
Yeah, I can definitely see how that sort of background would inform people's perspective. Yeah, I have a similar philosophy around like encounter with the quote other, right? And when you actually get to meet, I think part of what your podcast is so great at trying to achieve, right, is trying to reach across the expanse of America and the American experiences and sort of de-otherize people. But it's often when people actually get to meet people who are different, they realize all these sort of stereotypes or understandings or built up narratives that they had around who this person is and what they think and everything like that can sort of be deconstructed, which is part of what I was hearing in your response about your conversation with Dr. Roberts.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that I mentioned this almost every single episode, and more times than not. I mentioned the fact that I forget his name now because I mentioned it so much. I must have forgotten. Daryl Davis. That's my guy. Okay, I mentioned it so much. Damien remembers. And I don't. But that's beyond the point. So Daryl Davis, he, if you guys don't know, as listeners, if you're a first time listener, talked to KKK members, and by talking to them, having these conversations, he convinced them to disrobe, to take their robes away, give them to Daryl Davis, and renounce their membership in the KKK. Now, I think that sometimes people are beyond reproach. But in some circumstances, in more circumstances than not, these people simply haven't been exposed to people who, you know, defy that kind of cultural norm that they have in their faith, in their heads. I think that sometimes people have more pre-existing ideas, and having these conversations help to bridge that gap between people. So I think that that's what we try to do here on the podcast, and that's what I think that I have been advocating for a very long time. Now, I did want to ask you about your why you're interested in the you know, you pursued a minor in feminist studies, you earned your minor in feminist studies. So why do you have an affinity towards feminist studies, and what are your thoughts on how our democracy is laid out today, more specifically how we have a woman running for vice president of Asian American descent and African American descent in Kamala Harris?
Sure. Trying to think what inspired me to get my minor in feminist studies. I really liked, pardon?
Oh, no, I was just saying absolutely. My bad. Sorry if I stopped that. Go ahead.
I really liked the approach that I found in feminist studies. I think probably much like what you were talking about in your conversation with Dr. Roberts, I've always had an affinity for seeking out and listening to sort of marginalized voices or marginalized narratives, or thinking about, well, what's another, taking a large problem and thinking about what's another way of approaching this. And to me, feminist studies just sort of seemed the epitome of that rubric and framework to looking at the world. Every sort of large political, social, or cultural issue, you could take a feminist studies lens to and help reveal voices and people who are also there whose narratives are not as amplified. And in preparation for today, I was actually thinking about what are some things that I still carry with me from those,
right,
that from that minor. And I'd say there are three, and they're interrelated. The first is this concept, I'll always say the jargon and then I'll break it down, but the first is this concept that, you know, identities, race, gender, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, they're neither monolithic nor hegemonic. So what does that mean? It means there's no universal American experience. There's no universal Black experience. You know, you can't take, it's often what you hear students from underrepresented backgrounds talking about when they go into these majority dominant group settings, yeah. Right? Like, I feel like I'm being made to be the voice of what it means to be a Black person in America. And it's like, you can only say your truth to that, but you shouldn't be held as the monolith of what it means to be Black in America or Asian American in America. And related to that is this great concept called intersecting hierarchies of power and oppression. And it's the idea that we are these bundles of identity. So we're not just Black. We're not just women or men. We're not just gay or straight. Like, we're not just, from a working class background or not. We're a bundle of all of these things. And in different scenarios and environments, different identities are going to be more salient. And so that's another reason why you can't be held as a monolithic standard, because, you know, you have to look at things intersectionally. So I'm both a woman and multiracial, and I grew up overseas, and I'm heterosexual, and how do these things sort of combine in different social scenarios matters. And that's what brings us to the third part that I've taken from feminist studies, is now that you've realized that people are not monolithic or hegemonic, that there are these intersecting hierarchies of power and oppression, what can we do about it? And that's the wonderful thing of a both-and approach. A lot of problem solving, I think, approaches the issue as it's either A or it's B. And if it's A, the solution is Y. And if it's B, the solution is Z. And it turns out there are a lot of gray area right. problems in the world. And they need a both and approach. And that's the third thing that I've taken from feminist studies, is that you need to approach, you shouldn't try and force false dichotomies. You should try and think about how it's both A, B.
We got an awesome lesson there. Before you continue, Damien, I wanted to mention one point. I mean, first of all, I think that it was an amazing kind of, three-step things that you told us about feminist studies and what you learned as a person, which is what we try to, you know, promote here on the podcast, learning from conversations. Now, what I wanted to talk to you about in terms of feminist studies, since you have more experience in this than I do, I've seen this topic online, and it's been on Twitter, it's been on newsreels, news channels, over the past couple of days and months. And it has been this topic of imperial feminism versus colonial feminism. And what these writers have been saying is that a lot of our feminists that we look up to today, Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, these icons of what it means to be a woman, women's rights, things like these, they have actually contributed to the rights of women in other countries being put down. And that's what the whole idea of colonial versus imperial feminism is. They believe that people should not only work to increase women's rights in a place where they're at right now, but also work to increase women's rights in areas that are less represented and not push back upon those rights and be elitist in that mindset. Now, that's something that I actually don't necessarily agree with. I think that I'm still on the verge here. I wanted to gauge your perspective on what that is. If you have any thoughts to say to our viewers and myself, because I was super, super confused about that.
Okay. Interesting. I have a couple of thoughts and reactions to that. I think, you know, in feminist studies, there's always been this sort of large debate between cultural relativism, which is, you know, the idea that you know, how things work in your world, in your culture, is one thing, and how they work in another culture. So how right. things work here in the United States versus overseas. And then we try to think, oh, are there some absolute truths, right, about how right. things work in the United States that we feel like should also exist in other parts of the world? I guess my contribution to that idea, to your question, would be something around But that seems to be taking a very broad brush approach to problems, right? So that's that gets us this how to tie it back. It gets us back to this either or, right? It's either you have the same standards and beliefs and meanings around what it means to be an empowered woman in the United States, and that's how it should be across the world, or you allow people to sort of implement and have their own systems of meanings and their own cultures. And I think you need, that's where you need the both and, right? Like you should not impose your values or beliefs on others, but there are certainly issues that people in those countries will identify as problems, and you should work on those within their sort of cultural toolkits.
Yeah, I think that it's a difficult situation, and we find ourselves in an interesting and I think unique, when you're talking about international affairs, that is, where you don't want to step on other people's toes, and you don't want to indulge kind of into their beliefs and their cultural values. But at the same time, some people are always going to perceive, and we've learned that on the podcast, some people are just going to perceive things the way that they want to perceive to push their agenda.
Yeah.
And I think that me and Varun talk about it a lot, how we don't have particular, we do have biases. And I think that, you know, every person does, but we don't have an agenda to push. And I think that that's what makes it unique. And the fact that we do reveal the fact that we are biased towards one side or the other. So with that being said, I was kind of going on to say that, that there's always going to be the fingers being pointed, but I think that the right answer, and I hate to see division in something that is so important, right? You know, the feminist movement has taken many different forms, and some argue that it's not I don't know if the proper terminology here, so please excuse me, but I think it was like the old feminism or the conservative feminism, the kind of the original, you know, push that we saw 100 years ago in one day today. You know, that we talked about on an earlier episode. So this would have been this Wednesday's episode. You guys will probably be seeing this. You guys will be seeing this on Monday. So, you know, we talked about, you know, celebrating those 100 years since women obtained the right to vote, and how feminism has taken many different forms since then. But one thing that needs to stay consistent is the values of feminism, and that is to try to have equality, not just for women, right? Because even in the 1920s, they weren't just fighting for equality for women, for white women. They were fighting for women of all backgrounds and of all races and of all colors and of all sexual orientations. So the difficulty here is, how do we not step on other people's toes while still trying to push that message and not be perceived as hypocrites? In the sense that, you know, the whole imperial thing, I think that we just need to try to kind of unite on certain issues and not try to diversify. One thing that I think it was interesting that you brought this up. I don't remember exactly what sparked this idea in my head, but it was something that we had talked about multiple times on the podcast. And it's the fact that some people, you were saying that they carry, like African-American students will carry the representation of being black, and that everyone will almost come to them, and that they have to carry that representation, right? It's in them to be black, in a sense. And one, what that sparked was the idea that I've brought up on the podcast a couple times, where it's like, you know, some people just want to be people, and unfortunately they're subject to, and I say unfortunately because of the point that I'm about to bring up, but unfortunately they're subject to being pushed towards that race. We mentioned this on the podcast once again with Dr. Roberts, and I only bring him up so much because it's such a familiar conversation, such a similar conversation. But where, you know, we said that race, more than anything, and I think me and Dr. Roberts agreed on this, race more than anything isn't what you perceive yourself as or what your mom perceives yourself as. It's what society perceives you as. So that's an unfortunate thing, and I don't know particularly, you know, how that is concerned with feminism. But again, I bring this up because of the fact that when we saw, you know, George Floyd die, and you asked us before the podcast what really sparked us to start the podcast, and I said that we could bring it up here. So that was one thing. We had planned it for a long time, but up until that point, we were preparing. And when we saw George Floyd die, we decided that we needed to stop preparing and we needed to start talking. right? Yeah. We needed to throw everything to the side, and we just needed to go out and talk and speak our minds. And it was almost as in a form of therapy to us. And we just happened to record it and publish it. But George Floyd dying, I think the saddest thing that I took away from it was people saying that he wasn't a good martyr. Now, I don't see George Floyd as a martyr because I don't think that he died for a cause. I think that he died because of who he was, yes, but I don't think that he died for a cause. I see, you know, Martin Luther King III as a martyr. I see Malcolm X as a martyr because they fought their whole lives for it. So how important is it to know the distinction between representation and leaders within the representative communities?
That's a clarifying question. Is it that you're asking around, you know, what if you're just genuinely curious and you meet somebody who seems to have a background that you're curious about? Can I ask them that question, or am I making them be a standard bearer for that identity? Or should I try and find people who have self-identified as this, you know, as civic agents and organized around that identity? Is that part of the question?
Yeah, that's the exact question. I think the best example for this was we had, you know, an Asian American guest on, and I asked, yeah, you know, insensitively asked Varun, I'm like, would you by any chance know how to pronounce your last name? And I was like, I don't mean this in any like insensitive way, but you're of Asian American descent and you'd probably be better at it. And he told me, but you know, that's my exact question. It's how do, what should we do? How do we respond to leaders and members?
Sure. Around that is informed by my own personal experience. So I would say for anyone who's curious to learn about other people and their backgrounds and their experiences, you always want to approach it with this mentality of, you know, much like you two are both exemplifying in your podcast, is you ask questions because you seek to understand, not because you're trying to put them in a box or you're trying to use some sort of heuristic to make sense about them. And if you seek to understand, that intentionality can come across. Now, it doesn't mean that the person that you're asking the question to is going to be open to answering your question at that time. And you also have to be comfortable with that, right? You have to be comfortable with people saying no. And for me, I don't mind answering questions when people seek to understand. I think it serves two purposes for me. First, given my research, I always find it interesting. So I like having those conversations with people because it sort of gives me deeper background on what people are thinking about and how they're approaching these issues. And second, because I decided a while ago that these conversations were going to be happening and decisions were going to be made around issues of race and gender. And I wanted to be in them, because if I wasn't, someone else was, and I might not agree with what they're going to say. So I don't mind those types of questions, but and I think, you know, being intellectually curious is a very important part of a thriving democracy. But people have to be comfortable with other people telling them no, right? Like, I definitely have a friend who says Google is free, you know, sometimes you just have to be willing to do work on your own for a little bit, and maybe they'll open up later, but you can't make them give you the answer.
Right. And absolutely. I think that sometimes perspective, though, is what people need instead of real facts, because I think that sometimes facts tell you part of the story, but perspective is what you need to really make a decision, and that perspective is sometimes biased. Granted, our perspectives are definitely biased, but I think the perspective is something that every American needs and should use in creating political kind of conversations and political viewpoints. Now, I think that on the topic of having conversations, one of the most pressing issues that I've seen in having conversations, especially today, has been the fact that people cannot listen sometimes because of polarization along party lines. What I've seen with my friends, my peers, and people on the podcast is that some people are so true to their party motives in this kind of in-group bias that Dr. Stephen Roberts mentioned from Stanford, that they won't accept the other side's opinions as even valid or remotely valid. So I think that everything is an us versus them instead of we're all Americans and we're working towards the same goal. So, you know, from your, I just as a person, not as a person of expertise, not as a person of kind of investment in this. What do you think it takes for us to create equitable conversations? Because I know you've had them. You know, you're pretty prominent in the political sphere, the civil sphere. So I think I know you've had them. And I think that based upon your personal experiences, what does it take to have that equitable conversation? And how can we as Americans spark that?
Right. Well, I think part of it is what I was saying earlier was you're communicating a genuine intention where you are asking the question because you're seeking to understand. And you also have to be willing to not judge. I talk about this in my classes, right? We need this concept of psychological safety, right? Which is Amy Edmondson is a really great psychologist who found this phenomenon where if you are willing to take, you know, interpersonal risk taking, so you don't feel like you're going to be judged if you make a mistake, or you don't feel like people are, you know, that new ideas or different ideas are going to be viewed as invalid or wrong, you can actually have these really creative, dynamic, and innovative environments, right? And so now everyone's out on the hunt to figure out how to create psychological safety. And I think how you as an individual can try to communicate psychological safety to someone who you are trying to engage with, or a psychologically safe environment, how you can create that. There's both like a I feel like there's both a long-term thing that you need to be working on, and what can you do in the moment. So what you can do in the moment is sort of try to ask questions that just try to understand what the person's saying better, right? Not these sort of gotcha questions or backing people into a corner, but just sort of asking them more about like, oh, you know, tell me more about that. What do you mean? Right. Why do you think that is? You know, people will be quick to tell you their opinions. So you don't really have to worry about that. And then based on how you respond, you can continue to foster that environment. So oftentimes, you know, these are long conversations. I don't think people should approach them thinking you'll solve it in, you know, a 15 or 20 minute chat, because you're not even going to get the person to open up that much to you in that period of time. But you can start to sort of lay the groundwork on it. And then over time, they start to see that you are not, you know, you're not judging them on their responses. You are genuinely curious. You are trying to understand their perspective. And then after that, you can start to, you know, say, that's interesting. I never thought about it this way. Yeah. This is how I've been thinking about it. What do you think about that? Yeah. And so you just kind of have to like draw them into your conversation as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a very, I guess it would be an analogy, but something that's very similar to it is I'm trying to learn. I am bilingual. And so I've seen both sides of this, right? I'm trying to learn Arabic. It is not easy, but I'm taking my time and trying to learn it. But you know, and being bilingual and speaking Spanish fluently, you know, when, especially since Spanish is such a prominent language to be learned in the United States, you have people come up to you and ask you, you know, how do you say this? How do you say that? And at first, I think, you know, some people might perceive it. I never did, but I know that some people might perceive it as insensitive. Like, why are you asking me? Because I'm Mexican, or because I'm Honduran, or because I'm Colombian? That's why you're asking me how you say something. But after a while, you can distinct the people that are trying to get the answers right on the test and the people that are really trying to learn, right? Trying to learn the language. Right. And they come up to you and they actually ask you. And I think that conversations in themselves, I know this might sound weird, but conversations in themselves are almost like learning a language. You have to learn how to talk to different people differently. And in that sense, I think that it's very important that we're not afraid to mess up, because in learning languages, I think the number one thing that I have seen, and I make fun of my girlfriend for it all the time, but you know, it's the fact that she was too shy to mess up. Right, she was too shy to make a mistake, so she wouldn't speak Spanish, and then she ended up dropping Spanish because when it was her turn to speak, she wouldn't speak because she was nervous she would mess up. And if you have that same idea when it comes to having a conversation, because someone is different with you and they won't agree with your ideology, then you will never learn. And that's what ends up happening. And I think it's not only in learning languages, but I think that there's a thousand different things that, that this idea could be presented in. You have to be willing to get out of your comfort zone. But with that being said, Summer, I want to, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And as we do with all our guests, I want to ask you one final question. And that is, if you had one saying, one message, one thing that you could leave to America's youth from you, what would it be?
A great way to end. I think I'll just follow up with what you were talking about there, which is you have to be willing to make mistakes and get out of your comfort zone. And especially around these issues of race, gender, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, all these identity-based dimensions that we have suppressed in the United States of America, and we have been taught good people don't talk about, good people don't think about people's gender, don't think about people as racialized bodies. Now you're asking them to talk about it, and they don't have the language. They didn't get to go to introduction to Spanish and start to learn how to formulate questions. And so I think, you know, being willing to get out of your comfort zone and approach being willing to make mistakes, I mean, that also means, for me personally, I like to assume positive intent. So I guess that's the other takeaway for the listeners, is that as you have these conversations, it'll save you much more psychological trauma and burden if you just assume positive intent and try to understand what people are asking you and have those conversations based on that assumption of positive intent.
Definitely. And I can assure you 1,000 times, if you listen to all of our podcast episodes, I have asked some very uncomfortable questions. And I think both me and Varun have. We've asked questions that have thrown our guests off guard, because in certain respects, they could be seen as insensitive. But I think it's always the positive intent. And I think that we come away with the answers from those questions that might seem insensitive with more than we even would have asked if we would have asked something that wasn't insensitive. So I think that having conversations is absolutely crucial. And I'm glad that we had one with you today. To our listeners, I want to let you guys know that we have a quick ad coming up, a message from our sponsors. And after that, we will be right back. Okay, now we're back. Sorry, we were having some hiccups. We're actually back. This should be the follow-up audio after we had Summer on, if I'm not mistaken, Varun.
Yes, sir. So we're back today for you guys to talk about certain issues that have happened since our interview with Summer. Going on to Monday, which is today's date, we're going to be releasing this at 6 o'clock p.m. So a lot of different things that have happened, especially with police brutality, especially with the RNC coming up, especially with the testimony of Robert DeJoy, the Postmaster General of the United States of America, happening between Summer's interview and today. I don't want to shortcut Summer's interview, though, Damien. I think she had a great interview with Politi, and I think that in the 30 minutes we did have with her, we learned a lot about her, most specifically about how we should approach just creating those interpersonal relationships, being good activists for change, and understanding different viewpoints. Because from what Summer said, I think we should all be understanding of different viewpoints, different cultures, different ethnicities, and having her background and what she's done before, her life of politics, her life of civil inquiry, it really gives us kind of a base going forward with our interview and during that interview with her.
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's very interesting. As I mentioned multiple times during the podcast, the parallels kind of between her and past guests, and kind of how all the guests that have this like notion and this, this idea that of equality, almost not all the guests, I wouldn't generalize it, but the majority of the guests, and it could be completely coincidental, right? But they all have this perceived idea that the way that they are, even if they don't, you know, say it, I think that we can draw the conclusion now, it's the way that they are, they are the way that they are because of the fact that they've traveled so much, right? And it's very fitting for Ted Terry to have been our first ever interview, because he said, you know, the way that you kind of cure ignorance is travel, right?
Right.
So,
and we've learned so much.
Yeah.
And especially from Ted Terry.
And go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
No, don't worry at all. I was just going to say the fact that, you know, since that interview where we said travel, it's like these people have been like, yeah, I lived here and I lived in all these different places and all these different countries. It's just something cool that a cool parallel that I've noticed between the different individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. And before we do continue, I don't want to mention that I think Stephen Roberts, as you mentioned, Dr. Roberts from Stanford, and Summer Rachel Jackson, the person we interviewed for this podcast, had a lot of similars, a lot of parallels because of their overall childhood, their upbringing. So it goes back to the idea that I've mentioned time and time again, and you've mentioned as well, Damien, on the podcast, of a person's mental attitudes, mental kind of state, and what they think about different people is determined partly by their childhood, by how they're brought up. And Nelson Mandela has mentioned this time and time again in his quotes. It's the fact that nobody is born seeing color. We're all born seeing a blank slate, but how we are raised creates the difference between us seeing color, creates the difference between us seeing diversity and accepting diversity. It's how we are raised. So I think that education plays a huge role in this. I think we should continue in our schools, in our kindergartens, in our pre-Ks, and even in our daycares to promote acceptance, diversity. Because if you're looking at I think it was Jason Bosky, who said this during the podcast, but he talked about how in these primarily, I think one of us or him said it during this podcast, but we talked about how primarily white communities, their children are brought up to not know about black people, not know about minorities, and not respect these people in their adulthoods. And I think that more experience, it's controversial, yes, but I think more experience in these cases, Dr. Roberts, the future doctor, Rachel Jackson, I think it does play a role in creating that kind of open-minded attitude, whether it comes to race, whether it comes to political viewpoints, or it comes to being a more concerned and open-minded American in general.
Yeah. Well, speaking of open-mindedness and speaking of race, this is going to be our segue for, like, I think this might end up being this might end up being the whole rest of the 30-minute discussion, because I think I'm going to have a very different viewpoint from you.
Okay.
So this, you know, with respect to the Jacob Blake situation, for those of you who don't know, it's a developing story right now. There was another, you know, unarmed African American male shot in front of his kids today, if I'm not mistaken. It might
seven
have been,
times.
It, yeah, he was shot seven times today, if I'm not mistaken. I want to gauge your perspective on the situation first, because obviously we started the podcast after the murder of George Floyd, what was blatantly a murder. I want to talk a little bit about what George Floyd's the police officer that murdered George Floyd, his attorney is saying, but we can talk about that a little bit later. I kind of want to gauge your perspective on this situation.
Yeah, and it's a saddening situation to begin. I think it's something that we all wanted not to happen, thought would never happen, and just protested against this happening. You know, the past couple of months have been people protesting, get your knee off of our necks. Get your guns literally out of our eyes, out of our personal bodies. I think that people have been protesting against things like these for so long, past couple of months, and this happening is yet again another wake up call that these protests are not enough. We have to have real action and accountability for protests, for police officers. Sorry, I think that in terms of this situation specifically, I want to go back and talk about first of all what George Floyd's incident did to situations like these. So, when George Floyd's death happened, the murder, the brutal murder that happened, I think in May, if I'm not mistaken, maybe it was
May 24th.
May 24th, right. And what that did was it highlighted cases like Elijah McClain, right? It highlighted cases like Breonna Taylor, which already was popular, but I think this case really, really started off that kind of rallying behind this effort. Now, this specific case, what happened was, like you said, the guy was, I don't know if you guys know, but the guy was basically trying to solve a civil dispute, a fist fight. And definitively, but he was trying to stop that fist fight. And in doing so, police officers thought he was doing something wrong, and rightfully so. They brought him over to his car and they were questioning him, but we don't know the specific details, but he was reaching into his car and they thought it was suspicious. So they fired seven shots onto his back with his kids in the car, his two little kids in the car. And I think the most atrocious part of this whole incident, Damien, is the fact that, as many people on Twitter and over the news mentioned, The police officers had multiple options of non-lethal force in this circumstance. Yes, I mean, I understand that they may have had a reason to suspect him of reaching for a gun or reaching for a weapon, but the fact of the matter is that they could have easily restrained him, right? Mm-hmm. They could have easily just stopped what he was doing in the most non-lethal way possible. They had tasers, right? They had these kinds of non-lethal opportunities to hold him back, restrain him, if they did think that he was doing something wrong. And even if so, if they used their lethal force, guns, they could have shot him once, which is not right by any means, but they could have shot him once. They shot him 7 times in the back. So I think there's a lot of stuff wrong with the situation. Luckily, and I don't know how the man is alive, but he is alive today. He is struggling, but he's alive, which, you know, by all means, thank God for that. But I think that either way, it is a unacceptable and atrocious circumstance, especially because right now with the whole ACAB movement and with the whole protest, police officers should already be much, much more wary upon their own actions, because this is just a blatant action of ignorance, and it may be racially motivated. I think there's a high chance it may have been racially motivated, judging that the man was just being treated in the most obscure way by the video that I saw. I don't know what you think about this, Damien. A lot of things that were said by me, but I want to get your perspective as well on this whole situation.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to correct myself. It was May 25th that George Floyd was killed.
Right.
But with that being said, I think that it is a very different situation. And I think that I agree with you on the premise that there was many ways that the situation could have been resolved. And I've heard on different accounts that there was actually a taser used. He was tased and shot 7 times, if I'm not mistaken. Obviously, there's still a lot of speculation as this is very much so a developing situation. Yeah. But with that being said, I think that, first of all, I've seen some people say that he was resisting arrest. Now, I don't know what the validity of this is, because in the video that I watched, at least, there was no arrest made. I don't know if there's a full video of it. There's no definitive arrest made at all. There is a point where the police try to apprehend him, and they pull on the back of his shirt. At that point, they're trying to stop him from what he's doing, which does constitute an arrest. So at that point, anything further that he does is resisting arrest, but only at that point, right? From the verbal cues that we got. I'm not sure if the police were, if they were wearing body cams. He might have been detained. I think 1,000% he was detained. Now, arrest is very different. You might think that it's coming down to semantics. It's not. They're very different things. And resisting arrest is a very serious crime. And obviously, you know, not following a police officer's orders. Now, on the front, I think that what he did was very stupid. And I say this because of the fact that he entered a vehicle after the police tried to stop him, and he was walking away from police. I don't blame him. I don't think that he deserved 7 bullets in the back. That's not what I'm saying whatsoever. I'm saying that we need to be smarter, right? And I say that with all due respect, and I'm not just saying that about my African-American brothers and sisters. I'm saying about all minorities. We need to be smart in the way that we're dealing with police situations. We need to give them 0% reason to kill us, right? We need to give them 0%. There can't be even a second guess in their mind, because they're already on high alert, right? We need to police them. And unfortunately, the way that we need to start doing that is by being careful with our actions. We need to try to, I know it's hard right now, right? It's hard right now to try to listen to a police officer and try to give him respect. I 1,000% understand it, right? But we need to, because if not, we're going to end up with 7 bullets in our back. And that might be a metaphor to some of you, but it's a real situation that happened earlier today. With that being said, I want to go back and I want to say that what he did, what Jacob Blake did, whilst being the wrong way to react to a situation where police officers, again, from what I'm seeing in the video, are trying to apprehend you, the police officers dealt with it worse, and it's actually their responsibility to deal with the situation appropriately, not Jacob Blake's. So we have to keep that in mind, right? It's not his responsibility to act like the one, like, I don't know how to word this properly. It's not his responsibility to de-escalate the situation or to deal with the situation properly, right? It's the police officer's situation. And what I'm trying to say in the sense that he's not acting smart is I'm trying to say that, unfortunately, it's gotten to the point where we need to take it into our hands, ladies and gentlemen. And it's disheartening, yes, but we are doing it for our lives. And you know, I don't like being dramatic or anything, but we just saw it earlier today. You know, we just saw it. But with that being, again, with that being said, I want to revert back to the fact that the police officers had multiple times that they could have dealt with this differently. I think the first thing that they should have done, right, is they see that he's going towards his car, right? Again, we're seeing this in hindsight. I'm not one for defending the police officers. Get that right. I'm not one for defending the police officers. I'm not going to defend them, right? But they see that he's going to his car, right? They know that he's going to try to get into his car. And they're, if I'm not mistaken, they already have their guns drawn before he goes into his vehicle, correct? They did not unholster once he pulls his car door.
I haven't watched the video specifically. I've read articles. I didn't get a chance to watch the video, but okay. I want you to keep going ahead. I'm going to watch the video as
you
speak.
Yes. Okay. You watch the video as I speak. So this is what I remember. He's walking around the front of his car, right? He's walking around the front of his car. And as he's walking, he has two police officers behind him. Both of them have their guns drawn. He's walking towards his car door. At that moment, the police officer should have read the situation, read what he's doing. Obviously, there would have been words exchanged before this. I'm assuming that he would have said something like, F y'all, I'm going to my car, or something along those lines. At that point, as a police officer, you have the authority to not only, you know, like Varun said, tase him. You could have dealt with that in a non-lethal way. You could have tased him. But more than that, you have two police officers. You could have tackled him. I don't think that there would have been anyone that would have interfered with that arrest. I think that you could have tackled him. I think that you could have tried to deal with it in so many different ways beyond that. Okay. The first thing that they did wrong was having their guns already drawn, right? So that's already going to be a pain in the ass. And I say that because they could have said, oh, we felt threatened, that's why we shot, but it's why did you have your guns drawn before he had even attempted to open his vehicle? They shouldn't have had their guns drawn whilst he was walking towards his vehicle. That's completely unreasonable. They should have only drawn their guns once they felt that there was an imminent threat, not beforehand. I know that I'm going on here a little bit, but I want to make sure that I get all my points across. Second of all, he opens the vehicle and he's still holding on to the police officer still holding on to the back of his white tee, and he's pulling on it. Again, you could have. I know this sounds bad, but I mean, the man has 7 bullets in him right now, and it's a miracle that he's not dead. You could have grabbed him by the neck, you know, not the right thing to do, but putting 7 bullets in someone is way worse. You could have apprehended him. You could have grabbed his arm, not held on the back of his t-shirt like you're playing flag football, right? Do you understand does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, you could have apprehended him differently, not try to hold onto his t-shirt. Especially when you're about to put 7 bullets in someone, right? If you're about to put 7 bullets in someone, it has to escalate to a situation where it's a last resort. And if you're going to tell me, oh, I tried to grab onto his t-shirt, he was walking away, that's not a last resort, right? That's not a last resort. You didn't try. You didn't try to not resort to using a gun. And if anything, I would argue that using the gun was your first resort, because before you even tried pulling on his t-shirt, you already had your gun drawn. Okay?
Yeah.
Second of all, this is what should happen. He should be fired right now. Fired right now. Fired. He should be put on trial for a murder. There's no
attempted murder.
Yeah, attempted murder. You're right. Because, you know, right now it is attempted murder. Killed. Right now it is attempted murder. If Jacob Blake dies, Lord forgive, the only reason that this police officer won't go to jail for the rest of his life is because Jacob Blake is a warrior. And he will prevail and he will live. And that's what we're all hoping for here, right? You know, at the end of the day, this is a tragic story, but we don't want it to end that tragically, right? And what we want is justice. So what needs to happen is this police officer needs to be fired, and he needs to be put on trial, just like if I would have done this to my neighbor, just like if I would have done this to a police officer, right? If this would have been the other way around, and Jacob Blake would have put 7 bullets into a police officer while the police officer was walking towards his car, then Jacob Blake would be arrested right now, and he'd be facing trial. Right? So why isn't it the same for police officers? Why is he going to get to go to work tomorrow? Why, as of right now, is he going to get to go to work tomorrow?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a lot of very valid points, Damien. I think that you mentioned a lot of good things. And in part, I agree with you. But I think you have to go back and understand why and where the situation was and what was happening during the time of this whole incident. You know, it happened because of an incident between two women who had something around a car. I think it was somebody keying car or something, a scratch on a car, and they were arguing. And Jacob Blake comes in, being the good civilian, de-escalating conflict, and talking to them, being like, this is how we should solve it. And that was marked as, I think the woman was marked as kind of a dispute. So the police were called. It wasn't a serious call. And they were called into the situation. And Jacob Blake was, I think, interrogated. So you have to understand the irony, first of all, behind what happened. Jacob Blake was de-escalating a situation, and the police couldn't offer him the same kind of actions. They were doing the exact opposite of de-escalating. Now, like you said, the point you made was absolutely phenomenal to me, and it opened my eyes up. I realized this, and I realized it more in detail after you mentioned it. The fact that they had their guns opened up before he entered the car. So it's almost like giving the person kind of a pretense. My guns are out. I'm following you. And once they open the car, surprisingly, they shoot 7 bullets into his back, right? And that's, I think, unacceptable, because the person he's walking, right? He's walking, and he's getting commanded. And I don't know if he was getting commanded, but their guns were out the entire time. And to be so surprisingly able to shoot 7 bullets without thinking twice.
They weren't even running. He wasn't even running. It was like, I'm watching the video right now. The police officers were following him in a light brisk, right? They were just looking for a reason to shoot him.
Right. So that's where the issue lies now. The issue lies in where the police officers are approaching him with a gun pointed, with them walking as if it's not that big of an issue, right? And they come up in the same kind of brisk walking, the same gun pulled out to shoot him 7 times with no pretense. I don't believe. We're still finding details. Yes, I agree with that, but I think there's no pretense towards it. And we also have to look at why Jacob Blake was going towards his car. The reason why is because he had 2 kids in the car. He was checking on them. And it could have been because he had, maybe if people are saying he had a felony before, may have had a criminal charge against him. I don't know about that. But the fact that I do know is that, first of all, he had kids in the car. He was checking up on them. And second of all, there were no guns in that vehicle. Yeah. There were no guns in that vehicle. Yeah. So that's something that's fair to mention. Yes, there's kind of some suspicion, as I mentioned. There may be a gun in the vehicle. There may be kind of a weapon in the vehicle.
Which is understandable. That's an understandable train of thought. That they're, okay, this guy is walking away from us. He's about to open his car door. There could be a gun in the vehicle. I was thinking it. I watched this video without any context, right? I didn't watch a caption. I said, why is this dude walking away from 2 police officers with his gun drawn, getting towards his car door? I'm not a police officer. I don't have any damn training, but common sense will tell me he's walking towards a car door. He's going to pull out. I thought this was going to be a video of 2 police officers getting shot. Right? That's what I thought it was going to be at first. But then once I understood, I was like, okay, he's walking towards his car. He doesn't appear as a threat anymore. Then he opens his car door casually. I mean, he's not reaching for anything.
He's casually opening it.
He's casually. And the sad thing is the police officers are casually following him. Like, hey, no, let's wait for a second.
The worst thing is, Damien, that they're casually shooting. Mm-hmm. That's the worst thing.
One hand.
If you look at how he's shooting.
One hand. First of all, it's faulty police training, right? He shot wrong. That's not how you're supposed to shoot. Okay? Every police officer knows that that's not how you're supposed to shoot. Okay? Every single gun owner knows that that's not how you're supposed to shoot a pistol. Okay? Second of all, he shoots him casually, right? This is the issue. The issue is the fact that we didn't learn after the first time, right?
Yeah.
That's the most pressing thing. The biggest issue is that it's been over 150 days and Breonna Taylor's killers haven't even been arrested. Right? We're not asking. This is the thing. We're not asking for them to be hung. We're not asking for them to be put on a trial of you know, on Twitter to see whether they're guilty or not. We're asking for them to be arrested and go through the legal process, the judicial process, as every single one of us would have to do if we did the same thing. What if I told you that 2 black men entered a white woman's home off of a suspicion that they had that she had drugs in there, trying to be good citizens, and shot her 16 times? What if I told you that? 2 black men entered 1 white woman's home and shot her 16 times.
The issue, I think I follow you. But the worst thing about it is that these citizens you're talking about don't have training. They're not trained to think about racial profiling or profiling of any sort, profiling of killers, of murderers, of criminals. They're not trained to do that. They're not trained of de-escalating. They're not trained of being good officers, creating good arrests. They're not trained. And the fact of the matter is that these people are trained to protect us.
Yeah.
And them doing this should, I think, first of all, constitute a same equal regard as us doing it would, but even a higher penalty because they're trained for it. This is their job. Our job is not to commit citizens' arrests. Our job is not to take justice into our own hands. And if we do, we're put on trial, whether it's justice or whether it's vigilante justice, we're put on trial. And if we shoot somebody, if we put a gun in somebody's back, we're put on trial.
Yeah.
As any police officer should, if it's not vindicated. I think they should be held to a higher regard because they have the training, they have the experience, they have the mental fortitude to make that decision, because to become a police officer takes a lot of mental fortitude, Damien. It takes a lot of mental fortitude. And them being able to do it without a second thought in the back of their minds, being able to shoot at least seven bullets, let me make that clear, into the back of this man's just body, with protesters and women in the back screaming, "Stop, don't do it." It takes the inhumanity. It takes is uncomprehendable. And as I'm reading into this, as I'm looking into it more and more, it is not making me feel any different. If anything, it's making me feel even more strongly towards this side of the matter right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I want to reiterate the statements that I made at the beginning. What he did was not smart. I think that everyone can say that. I think that both me and Varun could say that what Jacob Blake did was not smart. It was not smart to walk towards a vehicle while police officers are trying to either arrest you or detain you. And it's not smart, unfortunately, because you're an African-American man, right? That's why it's not smart. But at the end of the day, it's not his job to be smart. That's the point that I'm trying to make. It's not his job to be smart. He's not the one with the training, as Varun said. The one with the training is the one that put seven bullets in his back, ironically, right? The one with the training was the one that just almost killed two kids' fathers in front of, or two kids' dad in front of them, right?
Yeah.
That's the one with the training, right? That's the one that's getting our taxpayer money. Remember that. His salary is based off of the taxes that you pay, right? That's the one with the training, right? And then we go back to this thing, and it's unfortunate that we can't just all say, hey, this is wrong, right? We can't just all be like, hey, this is, why are we always trying to find excuses? Why? Why are we now saying, why is George Floyd, the police officer that is his attorney, why is he now saying that George Floyd would have died anyway? Why is he saying that the fentanyl in his system was enough to kill him? Why can't he just say, you know what, we plead guilty and we're going to try to get a lesser sentence and try to make this correct by pleading guilty?
But the issue, Damien, is that it's not about it being George Floyd. You're right. It's about it being George Floyd today. Maybe somebody else tomorrow.
Yeah.
And somebody else the next week. It's not about the person who it was. It's about the police officers. It's not about George Floyd. It really is not about George Floyd. I'm making that very, very clear.
Mm-hmm.
It does not matter who that was. I don't care if he was a murderer, a rapist, anything, a criminal, a drug dealer. It doesn't matter. What matters is what the police officers did and when they're able to do it to anybody. Because think about it. Did the police officers know that he had fentanyl in his body? No.
Yep.
They couldn't have known.
Mm-hmm.
So why does it matter to us? Because we're judging their actions without them even knowing that happened. Now, I think that the issue right now is that I think a lot of us forgot about George Floyd. It's been months. I think a lot of us are on the streets protesting, but I think a lot of us also, it's in the back of our minds, right? A lot of people don't remember that. It's the first thing they come to school, come to work, sit at home and think about. And now it's back there. This is an issue that keeps being proven. It can't leave our forefront. And looking at the RNC coming up, looking at the president coming up and speaking, I think he's not going to mention the racial issues. He hasn't acknowledged those issues.
He did.
So,
he did right now. And I'm going to say he how did? He acknowledged them. He,
all right, please
he
go
acknowledged
ahead. Please
them
go
like ahead. This. He was mentioning Barack Obama, and one of his constituents yelled monkey, and Donald Trump laughed. That's how he mentioned the racial tensions.
Is that today?
The president of the United States right now in North Carolina. This
wow.
just happened.
And
he laughed.
This is,
right? Monkey, wow. obviously, for those who don't know, is a racial slur when used against African-American people. There's no other context for this situation. The word monkey should not have been yelled out. What are you? And the saddest thing is his press secretary is going to come out. Oh, well, the president thought that monkey was a funny word. Yeah. What are you, five? right? What are you? You're the president of the United States giving a speech on why you should be reelected, and you're laughing because someone said the word monkey.
Let me clarify this for a minute, just so we don't get it wrong. He said, let's be nice, and smiled and pointed. So he didn't laugh, but he said, let's be nice, smiled, pointed, that said, this could only happen in North Carolina.
But that's your reaction, right? That's your reaction after someone says a racial slur towards the former president of the United States of America. Let's be nice. Yeah, let's watch someone call him a fat plump, and let's see how he reacts, right?
About being nice, man. Let's not be racist.
Yeah.
That's what he should have said.
No, he should have not said, let's not be racist. He should have said, we're secret security. Get him out of
here.
Get
him out of the place.
Get him out of here. Get him. Arrest him, for God's sake.
Yeah, and him even, if I may add, him even acknowledging what he said is giving a vindication, I think.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what he said, but him acknowledging it gives a vindication.
Let's be nice, right? That's ridiculous. Let's be nice. Someone yells a racial slur at a president of the a former president of the United States of America. And your response is, let's be nice. If someone yelled a racial slur towards Donald Trump, I don't think my reaction would even be, let's be nice. At this point, it might be, right? At this point, it might be. At this point, it might be. But seriously? Seriously. You're holding a re-election gig, and you're still trying to be divisive. I said, Rune, we talked about this on the DNC. I said the only way that he could come is he tried to give a sense of unity and a sense of compassion. Right now, what he just did was sided with a racist. And he sided because we stated it a million times, silence is complicity. But you know what's worse than silence? Is acknowledgement, but not acknowledging it correctly. He acknowledged this situation incorrectly. He said, cool. Let's be nice. A murder, right? A murder of an innocent black man just happened. Or not, sorry, I keep saying murder because frankly, it always ends up like this. It's sad that this is the exception, right? It's sad that the exception is that right now we're praying for him to live. Right now, in any other situation, it would be condolences to the family, right? That's what it usually is. So right now I'm very happy that it is, pray for Jacob. As he tries to make it through it. But, you know, an unarmed, innocent black man was shot in front of his two children today by police officers. Protests have arisen as we speak, and protests are rising as we speak. Across the country, if I'm not mistaken, protests are already taking place. I do not know how this is going to affect the RNC. The president might have to return back to Washington.
Well, let's talk about something first. Let's talk about upon your whole argument, your whole claim about the president acknowledging rhetoric like this. This is not one of the biggest things the president has done in this field. Let's talk about QAnon. QAnon is a 20,000 member group that came up in response to Black Lives Matter protesters. They're a group that has Nazi flags to talk about demonstrators and just to be racist, and first of all, to say Black Lives Matter is a terrible organization, a terrible movement. They've been punching, kicking Black Lives Matter protesters. There was a QAnon protester calling a woman in a crowd a colored girl and saying that, oh, we can say people of color, but not colored girl, and not being racially tolerant, or that people may even call it racist. I would. And we're having these same people just be the ultimate definition of conspiracy theorists, and they're the kind of people who have been flagged by the FBI as a domestic terror threat. These are the people who really really threaten the union in our country, the diversity of our country. They're the kind of people who don't want our country right now. And what the president has said about these people, and quote unquote, these are people that love our country. These are people who love our country. This is an FBI classified domestic terror threat who has Nazi flags surrounding protesters. There was one of these guys who pepper sprayed protesters because they were posed as a threat to him. These are just instances I'm reading off the top of my mind. Well, and it may be disoriented, but it's an organization. I don't even want to call it an organization that gives it too much credit. It's a group of people who are just divisive in their very nature. And the president, who's even more divisive, who's empowered that divisiveness, is calling it, these are very nice people who have stood up for this union and giving them credit. That's arguably even worse than what he said today, and he's been doing it for a while.
Now, let me say this, and we'll end the podcast on this, right? as we're going over our 30-minute mark. I think this is an incredible conversation that we need to have as this develops. And honestly, this might overshadow the RNC, as I said. The president's location might have to be, you know, not disclosed.
And there's protesters outside.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Well, let's say this. There's another group, right? There's another group that claims that they also love the union, claims that they did more than Lincoln, who obviously tried to preserve the union, who say that they, you know, they love the United States, who also pepper sprayed protesters. This group's name is the Trump administration, and it's headed by Donald Trump. And like this group that you're mentioning, whilst they do not yield Nazi flags, they do not stand against them, right? They do not stand against them. And they did pepper spray protesters for a picture, right? For a photo op. November 4th or November 3rd, if I'm not mistaken, ladies and gentlemen, we will elect a new president of the United States of America. We will. And the only way that we will is if you go out and vote. And if you're not going to vote for yourself, vote for me, vote for Varun, vote for the other young listeners. If you have the ability to vote right now, go out and vote and vote your heart out. Right. And if you don't want to vote for either Joe Biden or Donald Trump, go out and vote on and make an informed decision. Right now, it is beyond a right. Right now, it is your civic duty to vote. You have to. We are, you know, you want to talk about unprecedented times. It's gotten to the point where it's just ridiculous. We, you know, with the situation that we just saw, you know, unveil earlier today, there was no, you know, de-escalation of the protesters. There was no settlement of the protesters. So what this did is it might just awaken a second round of protesters. We'll see.
And besides voting, sign up to be a poll worker. Myself and Damian both signed up to be poll workers. We'll see how that plays out later this year. But sign up. If you can vote, great. Be a poll worker. Help the election process, because this election is arguably the most important election we've ever had. For the heart and soul of our nation, we have to be active in the electoral process, especially because our president is making it harder and harder for people to vote. So make it clear, keep as many precincts open as possible by being a poll worker, keep your precinct open, support the voting process, tell your friends to vote, tell your parents to vote, force your parents to vote. No matter who they're voting for, make them vote, because this president is making it harder, as I said, attempting this disenfranchised voters across racial, across any lines possible. So I want to make it clear that this election is very important. So go out.
Yeah.
Go vote, stand in these lines, pack a lunch, as Michelle Obama said, pack a lunch, go stand in these lines. If you can't stand in these lines, do whatever you can, check up, make sure your vote gets counted, because this is very important. And that said, to end today's podcast, make sure to visit www.politicteampodcast.com for more information and to donate to our initiative. And we'll see you this Wednesday for an episode with our Republican correspondent, Will Carroll, on the RNC, the first day and the second day of this convention and how it's going so far. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you guys for tuning in, and as always, thanks for listening.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politician Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/politician podcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/politician podcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/politician podcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politician podcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damian, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politician. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damian Galvin, for an amazing conversation. My friend, I do appreciate your input as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.